Welcome to your weekly Constitutional, a radio show where we discuss a topic that affects you every day, the United States Constitution. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in Grundy, Virginia, and I'm speaking to you today from WETS-FM in Johnson City, Tennessee. We've got another one of those strangely timely issues we're going to discuss today. We've discussed secession before. That's strangely timely here in the early 2000s, but another closely related issue that you've probably heard about is also strangely timely these days, and that's the issue of nullification. Nullification, the idea that an individual state can simply nullify, declare void, destroy a federal law, prevent that federal law from operating within the bounds of that state. Now, that's something that some states have insisted they have the power to do since almost the time the federal government was formed. But most casual observers would tend to think of it, if they think of it at all, as a 19th century doctrine, which at the very least was put to bed with the end of the Civil War. But they'd be mistaken, because even today, even now, there are people who are claiming that states have the right to nullify federal laws. Well, fortunately, I have with me today Joni Burrows from the Appalachian School of Law. Hello, Joni.
Hello.
Joni's going to explain to us all about these current calls for nullification and where they're coming from. Joni, who's talking about nullification?
Well, I guess we can start right here in Tennessee.
Tennesseans wish to nullify federal statutes right here in Tennessee?
Right here in Tennessee.
Well, who wants to do that? What's going on?
Specifically, State Senator Mae Beavers. She's apparently unimpressed with Obamacare, as people have deemed it, and she would like to basically nullify federal health care.
She wants to simply declare the federal health care statute inapplicable to the good people of the state of Tennessee.
Yes.
Well, that would certainly have an effect here, wouldn't it?
It would have a huge effect. Her proposal instead is that Tennessee be given the money to that they would get to run the federal health care program, but after that, the federal government would have no say whatsoever in how that money was spent in the state.
So she's happy to take federal money, but she wishes to have no federal strings attached.
Exactly.
Well, that sounds like a nifty deal if one can get it. Has she actually introduced legislation that would accomplish this, or has she actually tried to actually pass any statutes that nullify federal laws?
Yes, I believe it has not come to a vote yet, but she has already proposed legislation.
Wow. Anything else going on in Tennessee?
The House and the Senate both this year have passed legislation declaring that the state is not bound by federal health care.
Really? Okay.
Right.
Well, have they passed it? Okay, please go on. I interrupted you.
Oh, that's fine. Unfortunately, neither of the bills that were considered by the House and the Senate actually became law, but it was seriously considered for some time.
Okay. Well, I seem to recall that you mentioned something else going on in Tennessee as well that sounded very like nullification.
As a matter of fact, 2 years ago, the same senator, Senator Beavers, successfully sponsored the Tennessee Firearms Freedom Act. And that act basically said that any firearms made in Tennessee and sold in Tennessee are not covered by federal standards.
Well, now that's an interesting idea. And it is not quite as far out as it might seem at first, because, of course, by making that law applicable only to firearms that are manufactured entirely within the state boundaries, I see an attempt there, at least, to avoid the reach of the commerce power. You recall that the commerce power is the power of the federal government to regulate commerce, and that it applies to any goods, certainly, that move in interstate commerce. And so the flip side is that if you can create something completely within the boundaries of a given state, then arguably it's beyond the federal commerce power. But that, of course, is ultimately for the federal courts to determine. You know, the U.S. Supreme Court would decide whether such a statute does apply in Tennessee or not. But apparently Tennessee has decided to declare on its own,
yes,
through this statute, that it's beyond the federal commerce power. And that's where the nullification part comes in.
Right. And actually, Senator Beavers would like to extend this not just firearms, but any goods made in Tennessee. And she has some legislation that she wants to propose this year that would say that any food or basically any product manufactured in Tennessee, as long as it has the Made in Tennessee label, which would mean that it was completely made in Tennessee, would not be subject to federal laws like the FTC or the FDA.
Well. That'll be very interesting to see if those laws pass muster when they're inevitably challenged in court. But there we have it, at least two statutes on the Tennessee books that at least purport to nullify federal regulations and statutes. Okay, so
yes. It
is timely here in the great state of Tennessee. Any other states out there doing some nullifying?
Well, not surprisingly, Texas is also...
Texas! There's something with those T states. All
yes.
right. Well, what have they done down in the heart of Texas?
They are also not pleased with Obama's health care program. And so Leo Berman, a congressman down in Texas, has actually proposed legislation to completely nullify federal health care in the state of Texas.
So this is a Texas legislator, and he has proposed legislation. He's going to completely nullify the new health care statute.
Right.
Very interesting.
Right. And I think there are some other legislators in Texas that would take, I guess, a little more moderate stance, but still would like to replace the federal health care system with their own sort of health care exchange. I think it would be sort of like an Orbitz for health care. But they're also not a fan of the federal health care program and would like to see it nullified.
Okay. And in fact, I think I can add at least one more state there, the great Commonwealth of Virginia, where the Appalachian School of Law is located. Of course, there is a statute out there on the books that predates the federal health care statute, but does purport to nullify any so-called individual mandate to buy health insurance. And that one is currently being litigated. So nullification is in the air. It's all around
Absolutely.
Us.
Absolutely.
It's a very timely issue. So thank you very much for pointing that out to us. And later on, you're going to come back and tell us about the greatest advocate of nullification in U.S. history, aren't you?
Yes. John C. Calhoun, the nullifier.
The nullifier. All right. We're going to look forward to hearing about John C. Calhoun later in the program. Right now, we're going to hear from Joe Lane, a fellow from right here or right across the state line in southwestern Virginia. Joe is the Hawthorne Associate Professor and Chair of the Department of Political Science at Emory and Henry College in Emory, Virginia. He's also the Director of the College Honors Program, and he's written extensively about American constitutional law and history. Well, Joe, thanks very much for coming in today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Stuart. I'm glad to be here.
Okay.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm very happy to have you. What is your opinion on this very interesting concept that we hear from the Tea Partiers and from other people all across the nation, this idea that a state can simply nullify a federal statute, simply say, we're not going to obey that statute?
Well, I think we can look at this from the point of view of the Constitution itself, strictly textual question. We can also look at it from a historical point of view. From the strictly textual point of view, it's pretty clear that nullification is not present within the Constitution that we have in terms of its text alone. So we find
let me interrupt you there then. That is an important point you're making, because many of the same people who are claiming that nullification is a constitutional right are the very same people who will say that they are strict textualists.
This is very true, and it might be true, or at least in their own understanding, it may be true that they're strict originalists, but I think it's almost impossible to get nullification from a strictly textual point of view. There's nothing in the Constitution that even alludes to the possibility that a state legislature has the authority to make a judgment on whether or not a law passed by Congress is constitutional or not constitutional, whether or not a law passed by Congress would be operational within a given state or not operational within a given state. We find that when Madison puts forward in the Kentucky Resolutions and some of the explaining language that he did shortly after the Kentucky Resolutions in the late 1700s, and this is a place where people would say Madison supports nullification and would put a Madison imprimatur on nullification, what we find is that Madison doesn't argue from the Constitution itself. He argues from a theory of what the Constitution is, the importance of viewing the Constitution as a compact of the several states in which the states are the parties and therefore the ultimate judges of whether or not the compact is being followed in a given case.
So that's a very much an interpretivist concept. I mean, that you have to interpret the Constitution and what the purpose of the Constitution was before you can arrive at this idea of nullification.
I think that's true. And I think Madison himself recognized that there wasn't a syllable in the plan, to paraphrase what Hamilton says about judicial review in Federalist Paper 81, there's not a syllable in the plan under consideration that directly says that there's a power of nullification. What we have is a theory of what the Constitution represents, a contract among the states, a theory about how contracts work. Only if all of the parties to the contract find that the contract is being followed does the contract remain in force. And therefore, the argument would be that the states would be able to decide when the contract wasn't being followed and would be able to object that the contract wasn't being followed. But even then, nullification still has a theoretical problem. As you and I know from thinking about contracts in a legal perspective, if you and I have a contract and you think the contract isn't being followed and I think the contract is being followed, then we would have to be able to appeal to some judge who would look at the terms of the contract and look at what you said about why it wasn't followed and look at what I said about why it was and come to a determination, yes, in this case, the contract is being followed, or no, in this case, it isn't.
Yeah, in fact, that's the essence of a contract, is that people agree beforehand that they're going to be bound by the terms of the contract, and they're not simply going to say, well, I don't like this anymore, and therefore I'm not going to follow it. And I think that's what you're heading toward.
It is what I'm heading toward. And I think it's very important, actually, when we think about Madison's relationship to this idea of nullification, to recognize what Madison did in the Kentucky resolutions. These are resolutions in the 1798 and 1799, objecting to the federal government's passage of what were called the Alien and Sedition Acts, strongly Federalist-supported acts that, among other things, made it a crime to criticize the president, high-ranking officers of the government as having violated the Constitution. When Kentucky and Virginia pass resolutions saying they disapprove of these acts, they order that those acts be sent out to the governors of all the other states and ask that those governors circulate these resolutions objecting to these acts to their legislatures. They're hoping other legislatures will come out with similar statements declaring these acts to be unconstitutional. I think from Madison's point of view, insofar as he has something like a nullification understanding, what he thinks might happen is that if one state were to say, I think this law is unconstitutional and therefore should not be obeyed, that doesn't necessarily have any force. Madison never says in the Kentucky resolutions, the Alien and Sedition Acts won't be enforced in Kentucky, or the Alien and Sedition Acts will not be enforced in Virginia. What he does say is, let's communicate to the other legislatures who represent the other parties to this contract and see if they also will object that these acts are inconsistent with the contract that we've entered into together, which is to say with the Constitution of the United States. Now, historically, we could contrast that to what happens with South Carolina during the so-called nullification crisis in the 1830s.
Before we get there, though, this is very interesting stuff. So Madison, when he and Jefferson got together and did the Kentucky resolution, the Virginia resolutions, they really were resolutions.
They were resolutions.
They weren't designed to be effective statutes that somehow nullified a federal statute. They were simply declarations by the various state governments that, hey, we think there's a problem here. And, you know, if enough other states agree with us, well, then maybe there'll be some accommodation and some change in the federal statute. There wasn't an attempt there to simply say, we don't have to obey the law.
That's my understanding of the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions, yes. And in the Kentucky resolutions case, the one that was written by Madison, I think it's unambiguous.
Right.
That this is a remonstration, to use the language that Madison uses. We want to state for the record that we think that these federal laws are inconsistent with the Constitution, and we want all the other states to recognize that we are stating for the record that these statutes are inconsistent with the Constitution.
There's an analogy there. It's almost like a presidential signing statement where he'll sign a bill kind of holding his nose and say, but I have these reservations about it. Well, it doesn't obviate, it doesn't nullify the statute. It simply says, I have my reservations.
True, mm-hmm. With one possible exception, which if the president says I have reservations about part of this statute, the president has it within his authority not to enforce that part of the statute. He actually, after all, will be the one who's asked to enforce federal law, and if he isn't willing to enforce part of it, it's not clear that part will ever see actuality. Whereas it's not clear that Kentucky, for instance, in the manner of the Alien and Sedition Acts, has any role in enforcing the Alien and Sedition Acts. And so when Kentucky makes that objection, that statement on the record, it's not clear that it has any practical force.
Okay. Well, isn't it interesting that this, we keep going back to the statutes of the Alien and Sedition Acts of the late 1790s as the what prompted this first great discussion of nullification in our history. And I've always thought that that was nullification's greatest moment, simply because those were such terrible statutes.
But they were easy things to object to.
They were easy things to want to nullify. So your heart is with them. I mean, those are, for those who don't remember that from their history classes, those are the statutes that essentially that penalized all sorts of free speech, critical of the government, were very restrictive toward people, typically of French ancestry at that time. And so they were easy things to object to, but we've got to be careful not to confuse the issue of the moment, which was the Alien and Sedition Acts, with the concept of nullification. We're talking with Joe Lane, the chair of the Department of Political Science at Emory and Henry College, all about nullification and James Madison. But right now, it's time for our constitutional quiz. All right, once again, it's time for our constitutional quiz with Kelly Carmichael from the We the People organization. Are you there, Kelly?
I'm here.
Tremendous. What quiz question do you have for us this week?
As usual, I have a good one for you.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to get into this idea of political power. The question is, the idea that political power is derived from the people is called what?
The idea that political power is derived from the people is called what? Well, wait a second. Now, I thought that political power came from the lady in the lake and the divine right of kings, right? Isn't that where political power comes from?
Maybe a long, long time ago, but certainly not what our country is based on at this point.
I see. So we have an interesting idea. What are our answer choices about where political power is derived from?
Sure. Our answer choices are A, popular sovereignty.
Okay, that's what we call this concept that political power derives from the people. Popular sovereignty is choice A.
B is judicial review.
Judicial review is choice B.
C is unitary government.
Unitary government is choice C. Okay.
D is executive supremacy.
Executive supremacy is choice D. I'll let people think about those for a moment and mark down their own answers. Let's take it in reverse order, shall we?
Absolutely.
Just to spice things up. So executive supremacy, choice D, of course, seems almost to be the antithesis of the idea of power to the people, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. They definitely seem to contradict each other.
In fact, that's exactly what I was talking about a moment before with this idea of the divine right of kings. That means that, you know, God himself or herself, if you prefer, anoints a king, and the king, of course, heads up the government and is the executive of the government. And that's really just exactly the opposite of what we're all about. So I guess it can't be choice D.
Yeah, we'll eliminate that one. That's correct. And then C was unitary government.
A unitary government is awfully similar to the idea of executive supremacy, at least in its practical import. I mean, the idea, unitary government typically talks about executive power and how it's all held in the hands of the executive, or, you know, in our case, the president. And it tends to be a fairly sort of an authoritarian viewpoint of the executive power. So I doubt that is the correct choice either.
That is also correct. So we're down to two other choices. B is judicial review.
Now we know judicial review.
That's the easy one.
Yeah, that has to do with the Supreme Court and judges and all the rest of it. So we just scratch that one out completely. What's that leave us with?
It leaves us with popular sovereignty.
Popular sovereignty. And that makes a heck of a lot of sense, doesn't it? I mean, popular simply means of the people, right?
Absolutely.
And sovereignty refers to the basic powers of any government. So that means power to the people.
Power to the people.
Indeed it does. Well, that was a fairly straightforward quiz. Do you have anything to add to it?
Straightforward quiz, but, you know, popular sovereignty is an important concept that of our form of government and our democracy.
Indeed it is, and in fact that's very important to remember. Now, back in the founding era, You can find lots and lots of quotations from the founders that are fearful of or dismissive of democracy. Democracy was kind of a bad word back then because to them they equated democracy with mob rule. So they constructed a representative form of government with lots of checks and balances and lots of buffers between the people on the one hand and their leaders on the other. But it's good to remind ourselves from time to time that the ultimate source of all government authority, no matter how it's constructed, no matter how many buffers there are, the ultimate source of that power derives, in Jefferson's famous words, from the Declaration of Independence, from the consent of the governed. And so that is a very good reminder that even though we are a republic rather than a democracy, that ultimately that's where our power comes from the people themselves.
Absolutely. Well, again, always a pleasure to do these quizzes with you.
Thanks, Kelly. Your weekly constitutional will return with Professor Joe Lane and more about nullification in just a moment. Hi, you're listening to your weekly constitutional. My name is Stuart Harris, and we're talking today about nullification, the ability of a state to nullify a federal law. And we're talking to Professor Joe Lane. Right now, the conversation has turned to the person that often is cited as the original nullifier, a fellow you may have heard of by the name of James Madison. Madison himself is interesting. I mean, he also is cited as sort of the father of nullification, just as he's often called the father of the Constitution. But Madison himself had different phases in his life.
Absolutely.
And Madison himself was much more of a nationalist early on, and it was only later, I think maybe after Jefferson came back from Paris, that Madison started becoming more of a states' rights guy. Do you want to amplify that at all or talk about that?
I think it's important to recognize that. For instance, one of the things that Madison most wanted to see in the Constitutional Convention, and is unambiguous about this, both in letters that he exchanged at the time with Jefferson and also in the records of the Federal Convention, was he thought that it was vitally important that Congress have the ability through some sort of vote, he floated it both as a majority at one point, later as a two-thirds majority, to negative, this is Congress negativing, any act of any state legislature as being inconsistent with the Constitution.
Now, Joe, I am so glad you mentioned that. That is a little known fact. And let's just be clear about this. Madison wanted the federal government to be able to nullify state laws,
and says at one point in a letter to Jefferson, I fear without Congress having this authority that the government that we've established will never be able to be firmly, I think exact language is, the government will never be able to be firmly established. In other words, he thought that the federal government would be so at the mercy of laws passed by the state legislatures that it would never accomplish the great ends for which it was instituted. So you could see the comedy that would set off if he had gotten the power he so desperately wanted, and later had authored the Kentucky Resolutions. We could have had the drama of Congress taking votes on Congress nullifying the Kentucky Resolutions as inconsistent with the Constitution as Congress understood it.
Good heavens! Well, but we have to understand though that this is two different Madisons.
This is certainly two different places in Madison's career.
Oh
yes.
Yeah, I mean this was Madison the nationalist, and that was pretty much the stance he had throughout the Constitutional Convention. Mm-hmm. And right up through his drafting of the Federalist Papers with Hamilton,
at least. Yes.
Now this is where I want to plumb I want to plumb the depths of your knowledge here, because I've always had this impression that, of course, Jefferson's over in Paris during all of the Constitutional Convention, and the mails are very slow, so
yes.
he's got a big lag time. I have the impression that when finally Jefferson came back from France, and finally he had a chance to get into a room with Madison by himself, that Jefferson looked at Madison and said, what the heck did you do? What did you do with this Constitution? And that almost he had to woodshed Madison, and that Madison had a change of heart, and that's the point at which he began segueing into his states' rights guys. Now, is there any historical basis for that feeling on my part.
It's hard to establish exactly what affects the change in Madison's feelings. We do know that Madison cools somewhat to strong federal power when he sees what the first administration, the George Washington administration, particularly under the influence of Alexander Hamilton acting as Secretary of the Treasury, proposer of some of the strongest centralizing bills that get put before the first couple of Congresses, that Madison in those first couple of Congresses as a member of the House of Representatives starts to act more like what we would think of as a states' rights person. He objects to the Bank of the United States bill as being inconsistent with the limited character of the Constitution. He objects to some other strengthening of the federal government that takes place in those first couple of Congresses. But I've always sort of wondered if Madison isn't like the rest of us, in that it's often been said by political scientists, and I'm unsure of the original source, that federalism is everybody's second favorite issue. When they don't like what the federal government's doing, they discover that they're federalists.
Right.
And in the case of the Alien and Sedition Acts, you wonder if this isn't something of what's going on with Madison. It probably never occurred to Madison. In fact, he comes very close in one of his reports on this to the Virginia State Legislature to saying it in these terms. It probably never occurred to Madison that the federal government would do some of the things they did. He just didn't think that members of Congress whom he knew would pass such things, that George Washington, whom he knew very well, might sign such things, or John Adams, who he knew, might sign such things. And so now confronted with these laws that seemed so contrary to the Constitution as he understood it, but were nevertheless passed, he discovers that he's willing to take recourse in the idea that maybe the state legislatures can effect an appropriate objection. And it's interesting, too, from the point of view of Madison, that Madison, much later, also seems to come home to the Federalists to a certain degree. At the same time, South Carolinians are citing James Madison as the father of nullification in the early 1830s. A very elderly and retired from public life, James Madison is saying in his private letters to people, I'm with Andrew Jackson. When Andrew Jackson says he's going to force South Carolina to enforce this tariff that South Carolina says they want to nullify, the president's correct.
Right. Well, we're getting a little ahead of ourselves, but this is very interesting. So what you're saying is Madison started out as a nationalist and he ended as a nationalist.
At least more of a nationalist than the nullifiers of his elderly period.
Certainly. Right. But somewhere in the middle there, he was the nullifier and the states' rights guy. At least as he understood nullification.
Yes. Always uses the word interposition, but it's the theory that we've now come to associate with nullification.
That's very interesting. In fact, this actually is sort of what I would think of as sort of this middle period, the switch from the original nationalist to the states' rights nullifier. One could describe it as sort of a Dr. Frankenstein moment. You know, he's the guy most responsible for creating this new thing, this mm-hmm. federal government. And when it actually comes to life and starts moving around, instead of doing what he thought it was going to do, it starts breaking all the beakers in the laboratory, and he starts saying, oh, what have I done? You know, now I've got to put some shackles on this beast.
Right.
And so I think that's a very interesting way of looking at it. It's not that Madison got woodshedded by Jefferson. It's not that he simply had a falling out with his old buddy Alexander Hamilton. It's that he, with the experience he had in the first couple of administrations convinced him that maybe he'd gone too far one way and he needed to tack and correct course.
He had to correct course. I think that's exactly right. He needed to find a mechanism for speaking to the federal government that would force the federal government to reconsider some of the laws that it was passing.
Okay, and you've mentioned his later years, and you've mentioned the nullification crisis of the early 1830s. Let's put that in context for our listeners. What was that all about?
Well, in the 1820s, Congress passes a series of acts regarding the import and export of goods into the United States, and particularly that puts heavy duties on the importation of certain types of finished goods. And the southern states in particular were heavily dependent upon receiving finished goods and trade back from Great Britain in exchange for raw cotton. And so,
now, why was Congress doing that?
Congress was doing it first and foremost as a revenue-raising measure. It's pretty clear that the tariffs begin out of a sincere desire to raise revenue for the federal government. But there also is a tug of war that's going on between the North and the South. We have a party system emerging in the 1820s where the standard bearer of what will eventually turn into the Whig Party is John Quincy Adams. Most of his allies are in the northern states. And they're arrayed against, increasingly, two kind of cohorts of Southerners, Andrew Jackson on the one hand, the popular vote winner, but nevertheless electoral vote loser, or more appropriately, House of Representatives loser of the election of 1824, and John C. Calhoun, who was running, I guess we would now say, even to the right of Andrew Jackson and hoping to make himself president as well, each of them looking to build an electoral college coalition that was out of the South. The South, it was very convenient to look at these tariffs, as they would say, of abominations, tariffs of Northerners raising the revenue for the federal government on the backs of the Southerners.
Right. And also as a way to,
unfair.
And also as a way to protect the Northern industries.
Yeah, the nascent Northern industries and keeping those in business as being a leading goal, particularly of the John Quincy Adams group. Who saw themselves as sort of nurturing a commercial and industrial growing economy in the United States.
Most of which was in the North.
Almost all of which was in the North at that point in time.
So the South didn't like these tariffs of the 1820s, so what did they do about it?
Well, in a series of conventions, these were not meetings of the regular South Carolina legislature, though they were authorized by the South Carolina legislature. South Carolina eventually decides they're going to nullify the tariff and declare that it's simply not going to be collected in the port of Charleston at all. They're not going to allow federal collectors to get a hold of the tariff or collect the tariff in Charleston. They consider the law null and void there. And this in a practical sense, this isn't just a remonstrance. Hey, we don't like this. This doesn't apply here.
Right, and that was the biggest port in the South.
That is the port of the South.
Yeah, right. Yes. I mean, that was basically the New York of the South. And so this goes well beyond the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions back in the 1790s. This is, as you say, this was real nullification.
This is real nullification, and this is, from the point of the view of the federal government, not just real disobedience, but real disobedience over real money, a very hefty sum of money in terms of the percentage of the federal budget at the time. And Andrew Jackson decides, even though he thinks of himself as more states' rights than his nationalist rivals, people like John Quincy Adams, nevertheless decides that since Congress, in his mind, undoubtedly has the authority to levy tariffs, Congress and the president undoubtedly have the authority to enforce tariffs on states, regardless of anything those states say. And Andrew Jackson goes so far as to send, we would now say, back-channel communications to make it absolutely clear that if it came to marching the army down to make sure that federal tax collectors were able to get duties in the port of Charleston, he was willing to do that.
Andrew Jackson was not a guy to be trifled with.
No.
Now, he had a dozen duels prior to that? I mean, he was not a guy that you wanted to mess around with.
No. When Andrew Jackson said he was willing to march the army, one should assume that Andrew Jackson was willing to march the army.
Okay. And so he backed up the federal power with a threat of force, and then what happened?
Eventually, a form of words was worked out by which a law was passed that would lower the tariffs over time. We would say, I guess, that as targets were met, adjustments would be made. So as the federal revenue could be generated on less and less tariff, tariff rates would go down. It was about a five-year schedule. And this allowed South Carolina, and what appears to have been worked out ahead of time as sort of a two-step, to declare that they were satisfied that nullification had worked. Along with this reduction in the tariffs was passed a force bill, which allowed Andrew Jackson to say he had won, Congress authorizing Andrew Jackson to use force to collect the tariffs. South Carolina declared they wouldn't resist the tariff, but nullified the force bill, which was a moot point because Andrew Jackson no longer needed force to enforce the tariffs. And so the net result was that both South Carolina and Andrew Jackson claimed victory. The people who saw nullification as a true constitutional option would point to 1830 to 1832 and say, see, there's still a Nullification Act on the books. South Carolina nullified the force bill. That's still there. It's never been overridden by the federal government. And the people who favored a strong federal government would say, no, in fact, South Carolina backed down because we changed the rules for the tariff rates. We did that on our own free will. We could have marched troops down there if we wanted to. Nullification isn't constitutional.
Very, very interesting. So this is an issue of long, long standing in our country. But to get back to the Constitution, you point out that this is not something that's in the text. If you want to believe that it's in the Constitution, you have to pretty much go along with the interpretations that have been placed on this by James Madison at one phase in his career. By other people like John C. Calhoun, etc. But it's not in the text of the Constitution. What else do you say? Well, you said at the outset of our conversation it was another basis that you wanted to evaluate this on, the concept of nullification.
Well, the historical that we've been talking about now,
okay,
as well as
right.
the strictly textual. But, you know, the funny thing about the historical version, I wouldn't want to give away too much of the length of this career, but nevertheless, I've been teaching this constitutional development long enough that there was a time that I would say of nullification when we talked about it in a constitutional development course. Obviously, this is a dead theory. No one believes that
right.
a state can nullify a federal law
right.
and make that stand up now. That's been dead. If it wasn't dead in 1833, it was certainly dead by 1865. And we look at this as a theory of how the Constitution might have worked, but not as something that seriously happened. I guess the last historically really vibrant nullification period might have been resistance to segregation, if you want to think about it in those terms, in the 1950s and 1960s, though it was a little bit different.
Yeah, that was disobeying court orders.
Orders, not acts of Congress. But Cooper versus Aaron, nevertheless, and the Supreme Court's backing up of the idea that Brown versus Board of Education is going to be enforced, and we expect it to be enforced no matter what any state says, also seemed to be manifestly counter to any notion of nullification.
Plus the dispatch of the 101st Airborne.
Yeah, it certainly helps when you're willing to send troops to make sure people can get into a high school.
Yes, indeed it does.
That makes federal authority very palpable.
Right. Okay, so with that exception of the 1950s and early 1960s and the resistance to desegregation, you would have said this nullification theory was no longer current. But that's no longer the case now, is it?
No, it is not.
Let's bring it up to the present day. What do you have to say about the current crop of nullifiers?
Well, I think there's a variety of different forms of current nullification. I think what's interesting at this moment in time, from my point of view, about the modern nullification movement is that it seems to be so fertile of different ideas how this might happen. I understand you either have or will be speaking to somebody about this notion of amending the Constitution to explicitly allow a form of nullification, not state-by-state nullification, but nullification by a group of states, that the resolution of a certain number of state legislatures would override a federal law.
Right, the so-called repeal amendment's been introduced, yeah. But that would require a supermajority of two-thirds of the states.
It would require a supermajority of the two-thirds of the states, and paradoxically, at least as the language currently exists, the language that I've seen bandied about for this, would rule out implicitly, I would say, the possibility of state-by-state nullification.
Indeed, the whole basis of the people who favor the repeal amendment seems to be that we don't have the power of nullification, therefore we need this form of nullification.
Exactly.
Right. But at any rate, that's the repeal amendment. What do you think about right now the people who are claiming that that power already exists?
Well, I think the people who are claiming right now that the power already exists also come in two groups. There are people who would argue that state by state, in fact, there have been some motions in my home state of Virginia to do this in the General Assembly, that you could pass a law saying you disapproved of the Health Care Reform Act of 2010, and then in Virginia you would just act like there was no Health Care Reform Act of 2010.
In fact, that's happened.
It has happened.
They passed a statute and they said nobody shall be compelled to buy insurance.
Insurance. In the state of Virginia,
so
by
right
laws,
now,
state or national, exactly.
So right now we have a statute on the books that purports to nullify federal law.
Well, it sort of purports to nullify federal law. In the case of Virginia, which is not true for a couple of other states, including, I think, Idaho and Florida, perhaps among others, but in Virginia they did pass that law before the federal law passed.
Right.
Which does raise the question, constitutionally speaking, I'm pretty sure the courts would say Virginia had every right to pass that law in January of 2010, but it was, of course, superseded in March 2010 by the passage of a contrary federal law.
Mm.
Now, but in states where they pass such laws in the summer of 2010, then you have a real nullification situation where the state law came after a national law and in some cases explicitly and by name said, no, this national law doesn't apply here. Now, in those cases, you have the possibility of a patchwork of laws. The repeal amendment would say, get to this number of states, it's repealed everywhere, it takes effect in no state. These other state laws would have the effect of saying, this is the law in states where it stands unrepealed. So in some states you would have the Health Care Reform Act of 2010, in other states you would not.
We're talking with Professor Joe Lane of Emory and Henry College about the fascinating topic of nullification. After a short break, we'll come back and talk about the most famous nullifier in American history, and then we'll have a little more talk with Professor Joe Lane. Stay tuned.
I walk a lonely road, the only one that I have ever known. Don't know where it goes, but it's only me and I walk alone. I walk this empty street on the boulevard of broken dreams, where the city sleeps and I'm the
You're listening to your weekly constitutional. My name is Stuart Harris, and today we're talking about nullification. Let's go back to our conversation with Professor Joe Lane of Emory and Henry College. When we're discussing the most extreme form of nullification, when a state actually voids a federal statute and refuses to follow it, does that bring us back to essentially the Articles of Confederation? I mean, that's what it always seems like to me, is that if you really push nullification to its extreme, then you're at a point now where we really could be 50 separate sovereign entities as opposed to one united nation.
It's certainly possible in theory that that would be its effect. One could imagine that if nullification were accepted on the Health Care Reform Act of 2010, that it could become the case in many other laws. And I, by the way, have pointed out to some of my more conservative students when we've been discussing this year that this is a case where you better watch out what you ask for, because you just might get it. If these things were recognized, okay, these states have the right to step out of the Health Care Reform Act. It will never take effect in those states. What are they going to say when Massachusetts decides that they're nullifying the federal defense of marriage law?
Right.
What are they going to say when states object to, more pacifist states object to the taxes of their citizens being levied to support the armed forces of the United States in foreign actions, things of that character. And they say, oh, no, you can't do that. But I don't think you can have nullification for one party and not the other. This is, if you did get to that point, which, by the way, I don't think would hold up in federal courts or be recognized by even a rather conservative Congress, nevertheless, that would be the situation you could have, where every state would be making a decision about what set of federal laws they'd have and which ones they would not have.
Right, and you really would no longer be a single nation. You'd be much more a patchwork of different states. It's very interesting. It goes back to something you said at the very beginning of our conversation, is that here's the way I state it. I don't know how many people are genuinely states' writers, mm-hmm. as opposed to genuinely nationalist in their perspective. It really... Nationalists and states' writers tend to be very issue-specific. If you don't like the health care statute, then all of a sudden you're a states' writer because you want it nullified in your state. But if you do like the Defense of Marriage Act, well, then by golly, you're a nationalist. You think it should apply everywhere.
Exactly.
And that's the problem, is that what's good for the gander is good for the goose. And if you do it once, you're going to have to do it the next time and the next time and the next time, and then you're going to have a balkanized nation.
And that certainly is the risk, and I think that's the reason why, personally, why Madison, even when he was in his nullification phase, took the point of view that he did. He did not say, this law is null and void in the states where I've been able to get this resolution passed. What he said was, these states resolved that we think the law is unconstitutional, and we're reaching out to other states, we're sending this to all the other states, hoping that we can get a widespread agreement, in other words, almost using the states as the mechanism for an alternative national consensus, rather than using the states as a way of walling off parts of the nation to say, you know, well, it's not going to apply here, it may apply other places, which I don't think would have been Madison's point of view. I think he was always more nationalist than that. I don't think he ever wanted, as you said, to return the clock back to the Articles of Confederation, which he thought was a very defective system of government.
Okay, and that's another important thing to say, is that there are nullifiers and then there are nullifiers.
I mean, correct.
And Madison himself, even in his most states' rights phase, was not the sort of fellow who would say we simply get to stop the law at our border. He was a guy that was simply saying that this is an alternate way for us all to reach a different consensus, which might ultimately result in a repeal of a statute.
Right. It's not at all clear that wasn't what he thought the result, if you will, would be of getting all the states to pass resolutions like were passed in Virginia and Kentucky. was it that if all the states passed such resolutions, the law would cease to exist? Or was it a matter of building public consensus so that Congress would then look back and say, you know what? If all the states, or 11 of 13 states, or whatever, have I guess 15 at that time, 11 of 15 states, have passed such resolutions, then the conclusion we ought to draw is this is a law that doesn't have the confidence of the public and we need to repeal it. It's, of course, arguable that this is why some people are passing such resolutions in state legislatures about the health care law, not because they think they're going to stop it in their state, though there clearly are some states where they think they are or act as though they think they're going to stop it, but as a way of saying, wait, we're generating an alternative national consensus here to demonstrate to Congress how serious we are about the idea that this law is a bad idea and therefore that you need to take it down. And that kind of nullification, I guess public opinion nullification, the swaying of public opinion, is always theoretically possible in a nation like ours. As Abraham Lincoln often said, you know, ours is a nation of the public will. No government without it can long stand.
Right.
And if that's what they're trying to express, that's not a constitutional authority. That's a political authority you're talking about.
Well, Joe Lane, thank you very much for coming in today. This has been a fascinating conversation, not only about nullification in 2011, but all throughout its interesting and checkered history. So thank you very much for coming in, and I hope you'll come back again sometime, and we'll talk about some other interesting stuff.
Thanks, Stuart. It's been a pleasure.
Okay. It's time now for our constitutional profile. With me again is Joni Burrows from the Appalachian School of Law, who's going to tell us all about a very prominent figure in American nullification history.
Yes, John C. Calhoun. John Caldwell Calhoun was born March 18th, 1782. He was the fourth child of Patrick Calhoun and Martha Caldwell. He attended Yale College and graduated Phi Beta Kappa in 1804.
Yale College. Very impressive.
Yes, very. He also attended the Tapping Reeve Law School in Connecticut and was admitted to the South Carolina Bar in 1807.
Also impressive. Very few people attended law school in those days.
Yes.
Smart dude. Okay.
Very smart dude. He was, as most of your listeners probably know, a very illustrious statesman. He was a great orator. He did a lot in the Senate and in the Congress. However, even though he was known for supporting a lot of causes, he was not necessarily known for sticking with them throughout his life. He was pretty famous for making some pretty strong stances and then almost completely reverting from those stances later on in his life.
Well, he's not the first politician to change course, but okay, what were some of those causes?
Well, his first cause was the support of the War of 1812. When he was elected to Congress in 1810 to represent South Carolina in the House of Representatives, one of the first causes he took up was supporting the War of 1812, and he was joined in that with Henry Clay, as well as some South Carolina congressmen. And this group together was known as the War Hawks, and they were very supportive of the War of 1812, even though it looked like it was probably not going to turn out too well for the United States.
Ouch. That might explain some of his later flip-flops. You know, he won the battle. He got the War Hawks got their war. Didn't turn out too well.
No, it did not turn out well at all.
Okay. So what was next then?
Up next for him, after the war, he really bought into the idea of nationalism. And following the war, he supported Henry Clay in expanding public works in America. He really wanted to build a stronger nation that could fight future wars better than America had fought the War of 1812. After serving as a congressman for 7 years, he was appointed as James Monroe's Secretary of War in 1817, and he was able to further his nationalistic cause there. He was very active in supporting the expansion of the Navy, building of more roads. He really wanted to encourage manufacturers in the United States, and he also supported the institution of taxes as opposed to tariffs, which was a pretty revolutionary idea at the time.
Forgive me, Joni, but he sounded not like much of a nullifier. He sounded like a big government guy.
He was. At the beginning of his career, he was very much in favor of big government.
What changed him?
What changed him was actually the presidential race in 1824. He had originally planned to run for president in that race, but he did not get the support of the South Carolina legislature, so he decided to run for vice president. But the two candidates for president that year, Andrew Jackson and John Quincy Adams, actually ended up in a deadlock in the Electoral College, and the election had to be sent to the House of Representatives. And despite the fact that Andrew Jackson had the support of the popular vote, the House of Representatives actually elected John Quincy Adams as president.
This is sounding so familiar, but go on. I mean, this is not about the election of 2000.
No,
it's
not
about
quite.
The election of 1824, and it left a bad taste in old John's mouth.
Yes, he was not pleased with the outcome at all. As a matter of fact, he thought that the fact that the House of Representatives had elected Adams despite popular support for Andrew Jackson demonstrated that the government was very much open to manipulation by a very small group of people, and he did not like that.
Those nefarious moneyed interests of the Northeast.
Right.
Yes, indeed. The money men. And so he felt that he needed some sort of counterpoint to them, some sort of check on them. And what did he call that check?
He called that check nullification.
So nullification was a way to balance the power of the people who would manipulate the federal government if left to their own devices.
Right. And he actually wrote a piece called South Carolina Exposition and Protest. And in this essay, he basically rejects nationalism and brings up the idea of the concurrent majority, which states that if left unchecked, the majority is going to trample over the rights of the minority. And so to prevent this, there needs to be checks on majority power. And specifically, that check needs to be nullification by the states of any laws that they find that are not constitutional.
Well, that's very interesting. This is an additional, as far as Calhoun is concerned, then, it's just sort of a supplemental check and balance on top of the ones that already exist in the Constitution, which, according to his experience, had proved inadequate.
Right.
Okay, well, that's the theoretical basis, then, for what he was arguing.
Right. Now, unfortunately, this view was not shared by the president that he was serving as vice president under, which was Andrew Jackson. Even though Andrew Jackson was a very strong supporter of states' rights, he did feel that nullification threatened the viability of the United States and therefore was opposed to it.
And in fact, the state of South Carolina kind of called his bluff on that one, didn't they? And in fact, that was just on the horizon, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
What happened there?
There we have the nullification crisis of 1832. And what happened there is that South Carolina really did not appreciate some of the tariff acts that had gone on, that had been passed by Andrew Jackson's administration. And so they moved to nullify those tariffs. And in response, Andrew Jackson supported the passage of the
Force Act,
the Force
right?
Act,
yeah,
yes.
Exactly right.
And so South Carolina decided to nullify that too.
But Andrew Jackson was getting all of his laws nullified, and the South, South Carolina was going to shut down the port of Charleston, which was the major port in the South. Mm-hmm. And did Andrew Jackson just sit idly by?
No, that would not be Andrew Jackson style at all.
Okay.
And actually, the Forces Act was his ability to send military down to South Carolina to force them to comply.
And this did not bode well for his friendship with his vice president, did it?
No, it did not. As a matter of fact, after all of this was resolved, which it eventually was by another set of tariffs, there was a huge break between Jackson and Calhoun, so much so that Calhoun actually resigned from his vice presidency.
And I thought Spiro Agnew was the first to do that.
No, in fact, it was John C. Calhoun.
So he was the first resignation from the office of vice president. Okay, well, we're getting short on time here. So what was the other major issue in Calhoun's life?
He was actually one of the causes that he stayed with throughout his life was slavery.
So the one thing that this inconsistent politician was consistent about was slavery. Okay.
Yes, he was very pro-slavery. He opposed any abolition movements, and he also opposed any attempts to limit the expansion of slavery into the Western territories. He was also a supporter of the 1850s fugitive slave law. And as a matter of fact, many Southerners at this time referred to slavery as a necessary evil. But John C. Calhoun, I guess, put a little bit more positive of a spin on it, and in fact called it a good.
He put a positive spin on slavery. How was slavery a positive good?
Well, in his opinion, every great society has featured one class of people living off another less privileged class, and that was what was going on in America with slavery, and there was nothing wrong with that, in his opinion.
So it was just a tradition.
It was a tradition.
Just a happy tradition.
It was a happy tradition.
Okay.
And he actually saw the movement of the black slaves into parts of South Carolina where he lived. He saw that as a good thing because it displaced what he called the shiftless poor whites.
Shiftless poor whites who had nothing to sell but their labor, whose labor was devalued by slavery, and yet somehow this helped them.
Yes, slavery was very good for them, in his opinion, because he thought that it kind of instilled more of an idealism of, like, being civic-minded and a code of honor, if you will.
It prompted chivalry, perhaps, among poor white people. Oh, well, I've honestly never heard that one before. Okay. What else? We're getting close to the end of John C. Calhoun's long and storied political career. What else did he champion before he passed into eternity?
He was actually a big fan of the annexation of Texas, and which that I think was kind of ironic because the annexation of Texas that eventually happened spurred war with Mexico. And John C. Calhoun, who came into Congress as a war hawk, was actually very much opposed to war with Mexico.
Pray tell why.
In his opinion, he thought it was going to expand executive powers to a point that was unacceptable. He also thought it was going to add to the national debt. And he also thought it was going to add to Americans' lust for empire, which he did not agree with politically either.
Well, a complex man from a complex time, the godfather of nullification, John C. Calhoun. Well, Joni Burrows, thank you so much for at least attempting to explain this complex man to us. We appreciate it, and we'll have to have you back sometime.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
And that's our show for today. I'd like to thank Professor Joe Lane, who's the Hawthorne Associate Professor and Chair of the Department of Political Science at Emory and Henry College in Emory, Virginia. I'd also like to thank my student, Joni Burrows, from the Appalachian School of Law, class of 2011. Thank you, Joni. My name is Stuart Harris. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. And remember, it's your Constitution, and you need to learn about it.